Welcome to Eucharist Podcast, where we're exploring what it looks like for a community of disciples to live all of life in reference to Christ. Welcome back to the Eucharist Podcast. This week, we're going to be continuing our discussion of Chapter 3 of The Patient Ferment. This chapter is called Push and Pull, and as you probably heard last week, it focuses on what was pushing people out of their established social norms and communities, and what was pulling them into Christian communities in the early church. So people were having their lives disrupted in some way, and this was kind of, in a way, opening up an opportunity for them to be pushed out of their current state in life and pulled into a new one. And what are some of the aspects of the Christian community that provided this gravity, this pull to them? And so we're going to look at that this week.
The second half of this chapter is really structured in some ways around a question about how people in the early church period who are not Christians would have understood the church. Or if you were a Christian and you had to explain it to your pagan neighbor, like to what would you compare it? And he says one of the most easy or most likely parallels would have been something called a burial society or a collegia. Mm-hmm. And these were kind of like fraternities of some way, like local associations that people would belong to. It sounds a little bit like the Rotary Club or something for us and along those lines. They met monthly. They would have a meal. You had to pay a bunch of money to get into this. And then the benefit of this was that you had a kind of status because you belonged to this fraternity of sorts. And then they guaranteed that you would get a proper and honorable burial, which was mm-hmm. a fairly important thing to people in the ancient world.
So unlike the Rotary Club, more of like a social gathering, a social community that does good works, this is built around burial, which actually had a lot more gravity in their life. Like death was a big thing that was always kind of over their heads, and people, it was a big deal, right?
Yeah, it was a big deal for them. And so in a sense, the Christians took up some of the same aspects of what they were doing in the burial societies, but it was vastly more intense, is how Alan Kreider, the author, describes this. He says there was kind of a sense of gravity that what they were doing together, it really mattered. And a lot of what it was centered around was prayer and this idea of really wrestling with God for the good of the world, praying for people in power, for situations of need, etc. And then a lot of what they did when they came together was what they described as the maintenance of discipline, where what we would think of as accountability, helping correct people's behavior patterns that were not in line with the Christian truth or the Christian gospel. It was kind of establishing community standards in a way. And rather than pay dues, like in the burial society, the Christians, their society, their community was dependent on donations. So anybody could be part of it. You didn't have to be upper class or didn't have to make a certain amount of money, which meant that slaves were a part of it, that women were part of it, were actually in the burial societies, at least the example he gave, women were not allowed to be part of that burial society. So the Christian church had a kind of attraction of being this horizontally even community in which anybody could participate. And even beyond that, where everybody would get an honorable burial, whether you paid your dues or there were no dues, whether you contributed or not. And there was a sense of sharing that was going on. They had something called an arca, which was a community chest where, like if somebody had a crisis happen in their family, that the community, they would then be able to take out funds and give it to them. So it was like a social safety net at some level as well, too, mm-hmm. and what was going on.
I think it's interesting, too, because this might sound a little bit strange from like our Western contemporary culture, because I think there's been a disassociation with our bodies in a way, where death, you know, we are a lot more disembodied and the core of our person is not in any way connected with our body. Mm-hmm. And so there's almost a disgrace or a degradating of our physical body. And so like physical burial, which would have been very important to generations past, I think is less important to many of us nowadays. And so it might seem strange for people to gather together around burial or that it was such a amazing thing for Christians to actually take care of everybody, that everybody would get an honorable burial.
Yeah.
Because now in light of cremation and just all these different things, I don't know. Maybe this is just me, but it seems that there's this culture around death where it doesn't matter as much. Your body doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's more of just a coping, you get together to remember somebody, and it's not so much, the stakes aren't as high or as important, I think, to us nowadays as it was for them back then. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that the some of the legacy of Descartes and the Enlightenment, which is centering so much of the human person in reason and in rationality, we still, that still impacts our culture. But that's not Christian thinking. Christian thinking is very much, because of the incarnation of Jesus, is, honors the body.
Yeah.
And the body is something to be handled with care and with love and with respect. And, you know, Christians, I remember this reading this somewhere else, but Christians would bury the body. Then a year later, they'd dig it up and they'd collect the bones and put it in a bone box called an ossuary in many cases and keep the bones, which is why when you go to, you know, Europe or you go to places where there's cathedrals, you'll have these, you know, these special little remnants of the saints and bone chips or whatever else that came from these ossuaries because people really cared about the body in that way. And it seems a little funny to us because we want to discard the body as fast as possible. Like we don't like to be around death. We want to see it removed, or we don't want to see it, so it's removed as quickly as possible. But I think in the ancient world, death was much more common, and it had carried a lot more gravity to it as well.
I think the only point of contact I would have with something like that would be having my grandparents' Bible. Like for them, like having my grandpa's Bible or my grandma's Bible is very sentimental to me, and it seems like a connection with them. And and for me, that's where I've kind of seeded this semblance or this desire of continuity or respect for them, even though they're dead, is honoring something that was very important to them. But it seems for the early Christians, it was not just the family Bible, but actually the people themselves. Everything about them, it was a little bit more holistic.
And it's interesting too, because they simultaneously honor the body and yet recognize that something of their spirit or their soul or whatever was with God when they died, if they were Christians, and in a pre-resurrection state, so like an interim state of some kind. And so Christians would actually go and they would celebrate the Eucharist on the anniversary of an important martyr's death on the place where they died. And in a sense, they were trying to commune with them at some level, because in taking the, this is probably way, way far away from the chapter here, but in taking communion together, when you enter into the Eucharist or take communion, you're kind of transcending time and space. And so in a sense, they are feasting together with all those who are in communion with God. Whenever we're doing Eucharist, we do that, but they recognize that. So they do this on the anniversary at the physical location where the person's remains were or had been. And yeah, so there's a continuity between incarnation.
I think that's just so interesting, because I remember when I lived in Canada with a Korean couple or with a Korean family, I was woken up in the middle of the night, and I came down to the living room, and there they were as a family singing worship songs and doing a Bible study. And I was like, I was completely thrown off. And they explained to me, oh, this was actually the anniversary of our grandfather's death. And so we get together every year at the time of his death on this day, and we worship and we thank the Lord for him, thank the Lord for preserving him through famine and war, and the fact that he was who he was allowed me and our family to be who we are and worshiping him now. And so this is a way of us honoring him and his role in our family and in the world. And I found that so interesting, because obviously if you go back far enough, like their culture wasn't as influenced by Descartes and this disembodied self as ours is. And it really opened my eyes to the role of ritual and death as this really important part of the Christian life. It kind of opened my eyes to, it helped me to understand so much of the historic Christian church's interaction with death and why they actually celebrated and the death of people and actually honored their bodies and stuff.
This parallel between a burial society and the church was a fairly intuitive one for a lot of them, not so much for us, as we've been saying. But the burial society, or the church, was not really a burial society. It was the church. And as such, it was built actually around, a primary meeting was around a meal, which our colleague Kyle was really excited about when he read this chapter. He was like, see, it's all about the meal, because he loves the food and the meals. And it was a highly participatory worship service. There was a focus on prayer again. And the church itself formed not just a portion of the person's life. It was really, they really couldn't, the early Christians couldn't understand themselves apart from the church. And I want to read a little section here from, this is on page 60 in the book. And this is a little summary of how they understood their life together. The author says, these pagan associations differed with the church in the sheer density of their common life. The church met together much more frequently, not monthly, but at least weekly, and often throughout the week as well. The Christian assembly was not one of a palette of social commitments of an urban Roman. It was the center of the Christians' lives. It was not one aspect of a varied religious life. It was their religious life. The Christians were creating an alternative community that had nonconformist approaches to social problems and that imparted to its participants a powerful sense of individual and group identity. This had immense formative power. The church's members, whatever their social origin, sensed themselves to be a new family, brothers and sisters. I just think that's so great as a summary of what's going on in the early church, the density of life, the fact that the center of their social life, it all works around the Christian community at some level.
I think what gives this even more gravity for me is how much in this chapter, and as we know through history, how diverse the Christian community was. So it wasn't just, you know, one class of people that all had the weekend off, and so they got together on the weekends or whatnot. It was the poor and the rich together. People that probably did not have a lot of free time.
Long before there was established sort of a five-day work week, right?
Exactly.
Like slaves had to get up really early or come late, and that the Christian gathering was flexible because of those reasons. It wanted to include these people.
Yeah, and that they made the space. Early on in my Christian formation, there was a mentor that told me, you make time for what's important to you.
Right.
You know, show me your schedule and I'll show you what's important to you.
That's exactly right.
And it looked like the early church, what was important to them was meeting together, sharing meals, even if it meant waking up early or completely restructuring their life to do that.
I think that's a point of relevant application to our setting. It's a question that I have. I've been here in the city now like a little more than 8 years, 8.5 years. And what I have noticed in being here is that people come to the city in many cases because a job brought them here or they came for school or something like that. And so the church, if they're Christians, the church is kind of like a supplement to the reason why they're here. It's not really why they're here. And there's interesting tension in that. At one level, I understand that. That's totally reasonable and appropriate. Makes sense as to, you know, someone follows a job here. That's why they came here. But one of the things that does, it makes the church a kind of chaplain agency rather than the center of a social identity life, you know? So one of the things that we want to do at Eucharist Church is we want to have a beautiful life together that isn't just merely supplemental to the rest of life that is going on. And I think that's really challenging to some people because some people come to church and what they really want is they would just want an hour and 15 minutes of worship and they want to go home and that's it. But the early church would have known nothing like that. And that one of the reasons we're learning from the early church is that there's a kind of robust life and a vibrancy and a growth and a transformative power that was existent in that church that we long for. And not to idealize it, there's plenty of problems in the early church. But I don't think that in a place like San Francisco, the church would ever be healthy and vibrant if it just merely stays in a chaplaincy mode where it kind of, you know, if things are really bad in your life, then you turn to the church or you come once in a while to get a little spiritual nourishment and refreshment. It's just that consumer mindset violates the very core principle of what the church is. And I think that unless we feel that rub, which is partly why we're reading this book and talking about it, that we want to feel that rub. Like, how are we different? Well, that's how we're different. Like, you know, and in the early church, people had jobs and careers and they had slaves didn't have a lot of freedom. But they, like, as you just said, they made time for what mattered to them. And until we have that kind of mindset at the core of what we're doing here, It's kind of like spitting into the wind in terms of the intensity of what's happening in the Bay Area and culture and, you know, jobs, whatever.
And with that, I think it's interesting. On page 61, it talks about how Christians were able to embody an alternative habitus because they were convinced that they experienced God's energizing reality. So there was a sense of this wasn't just a social convention, a social community.
Yep.
But like it talked about, what is it later on or higher up on the page, on page 61, it says, when they'd meet together, they'd mass their forces to wrestle with God in prayer. And it just talked about how vibrant their life with God was together, their life with Christ together was, how thick it was, how much it was this energizing, passionate, full experience together.
Yeah. And that doesn't happen accidentally. You know, I mean, that people want a healthy church and a vibrant church. Well, it takes a deep kind of investment together and building a life together, a habitus together, as you've been talking about.
Yeah. It went on to say that, you know, they prayed passionately for divine provision, protection, as they encountered sickness, temptation, poverty, demonic possession. And it seemed that they built their whole daily lives upon the sense, here it says, sense themselves to only be able to survive if God was real to them and answered their prayers.
Yeah, it was a community of dependence. Like they, it only existed because they really thought that they had to have it. It wasn't like, you know, you think of like people who take a little bit of vitamins here and there. It wasn't supplement like that. It was like the meal, the full meal. It was like the real thing, the main course of their lives. And then to end this here, the end of the chapter, he really goes through, so how did this play itself out? Well, one of the ways it plays itself out is that at a certain point in, at several certain points in history, in the Roman Empire, there were crises. At one point, there was a major plague that hit, that killed somewhere between 1 to 10 million people, and many, many more were sick. And one of the ways the church displayed itself was in those moments, rather than just fleeing, these people who had become a community together, well, first of all, they didn't abandon each other. They really cared for each other. But beyond that, they then expressed the overflow of their compassion for the community around them. And they were the ones who stayed and served and nursed the sick and cared and sometimes got sick and died themselves because of that. But there was a powerful witness that there was something that transcended the importance of now, that like kept them engaged in these acts of compassion for each other. Well, thanks for joining us for our discussion of the second half of chapter 3 of The Patient Ferment of the Early Church. We look forward to having you join us next time.